Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Jim Henshaw, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jim.
Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at Napa Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with one or more years of sobriety tells his or her story. And this reading that I'm going to do now is based on passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Quote, "Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, 'Yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing.'" Tonight's speaker is Chris N. I have known this guy for a while. He's a good friend of mine. He's an average human being. He has a bright mind. He has a deep curiosity. He has a fascination with details that I don't even want to know about sometimes. On the other hand, he's worked his butt off in this program, in my experience. He's discovered some things that have changed him. Tonight, I hope he'll tell you most of it. What I remember about him is that he reminds me of a possum that crossed the road on the way, as I was on the way over here. As I first got to know this guy, he was very careful and very hidden and very quiet. Now, he's sometimes quite bombastic. As a matter of fact, he loves AA. I could talk too much and they warned me against that. So what I'll tell you is that he reminds me of what Nelson Mandela told us. Because he has a bunch of terrible fears and he's met most of them. What Mandela had to say to us is the greatest fear a human being usually has is fear of his own power. I give you Chris.
All right. Yeah, I'm Chris Noto, and I'm an alcoholic. Good to be here with you this evening. We'll see how good it is that I'm your speaker this evening. I'm going to try and stay somewhat on the beam with the time, and I know there's plenty of you with, you can see the clock better than I can at the back of my head, so you'll remind me if I need reminding, right? Okay. My sobriety date is March the 25th, 2005. Now, I attended an AA meeting. I was about 2-3 years sober, and I wasn't sure if my sobriety date was March the 25th or March the 27th, and boy, did I catch some harsh words from some fellas in that meeting. "How could you not know your sobriety date?" Luckily, a friend reminded me later that I had taken my 9-month chip on Christmas Day the first year. So now I know for sure my sobriety date was the 25th of March that year. Okay, good start. But actually, things started a long time before that, for me at least. I don't know about y'all, but some of these things that I read up here are a little confusing. When it talks about being restored to sanity, I'm a little iffy about that because I'm not sure that I ever was really absolutely sane as society counts sane. Truth is, I was born with a set of genes that included alcoholism, in my estimation at least. Not that anybody said to me, "Your grandfather was an alcoholic," or "Your great-grandfather." But, you know, there are stories that just add up to that. In fact, I have one great-grandfather. There are two stories that are told about how he died. And, you know, some a little funny about that. The one story, that the first ever story I heard was from his daughter, my grandmother, my dad's mother. And when I was about 20 years old, I asked her about her dad and how he died. I knew he died when she was real young, and that changed things for her and made her early life especially really tough. She was about 12 when he died. She said, well, he was hit by a streetcar. Now, I don't have any direct recollection of streetcars, but, you know, they travel on tracks. This was in the city of Chicago. First thing, they travel on tracks, so they're pretty predictable. You know, it's going there, right? Unless something real strange happens. And they don't make any sudden changes in, you know, they don't go from 0 to 60 in 3 seconds, and they don't stop on a dime either. So getting hit by a streetcar is, you know, man had to work on that. Might he have been inebriated? I don't know. But the fact that there are two stories. When I told my dad, my younger brother years later asked in my presence, asked my dad how his grandfather died, and I popped off with the answer, you know, oh, he was hit by a streetcar. My dad said, no, that's not true. He died a normal death in a hospital. I was like, okay, I guess I heard wrong. But, you know, somehow there got to be two stories, and which makes me think there was something to cover up. And what is, you know, if it's not shameful, why make a cover story, right? We didn't want to have alcoholics in that side of the family. That, after all, was the side of my dad's Sicilian family that left the old neighborhood where all the bad people were and moved out to the country. Well, it was the edge of town anyway. They bought two city lots, and they had a little house, and they raised their own animals and their own garden. And, you know, my great-grandmother was still canning her own tomatoes when I was a little boy. Beautiful. Oh. Anyway, so I think I'm pretty sure I got alcoholics on both sides. My mother told me the story about how when she was a little girl, and I didn't add this up until I became convinced I was an alcoholic. Cute story, right? Little girl, her dad would give her a nickel and a bucket and send her to the tavern on the corner to get him a bucket of beer. Well, you know, and there's my one recollection of being at his home the last year of his life, and his breakfast one morning was a tall mug full of beer with a raw egg at the bottom. Maybe another hint. I don't know. So there was, along with these genes in the background, there was a real disruptive kind of household that I came into. A lot of violence, a lot of unpredictability, a good performance outside. You know, nobody in the community knew anything strange was going on in the house. And but, you know, you never knew what was going to happen when Dad came home from work. Or, for that matter, what was going to happen any morning when he was home for work. One strange thing about my alcoholic career is I never experienced a blackout from alcohol, but I have a couple other blackout stories to tell. And the first one is when I was about 3 years old. My mom made breakfast. I'm pretty sure it was a Saturday or Sunday morning because Dad was home, and carried the breakfast to him on a TV tray table and set it up in front. And there was something he found lacking in the breakfast. And he let her know. And then he let her know. And then he let her know. And then she ran crying the 20 steps from that room where the TV was to the bathroom. It was a little bitty Chicago two-bedroom apartment. And he was right on her heels. And I was right on his heels. And she got to the bathroom door first, and it was, you know, one of those 3-inch thick oak things that used to be everywhere, slammed the door and locked it, and burst into tears. And he kept going with how he was going. And the last words I remember her saying, well, you know, it was, she was weeping pretty hard, and he made fun of her. He said, she blew her nose, and he said, "That's right, blow your horn." And wanting to be one of the cool guys, I was about this tall, probably 3 years old, I piped in, "That's right, blow your horn." And suddenly, Dad, who'd been focused at the door, turned. And that's the last thing I remember that story. Dad turned. That's the end of the story, as far as I know. And I never thought anything strange about that until about 5 years ago. I did some work with a lady on PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and she pointed out two places where I had stories that ended with, "I don't know what happened next," you know, and that was the first one of them. The second one happened when I was 9 years old, and that was the first time I decided I'd be better off in the big world outside than in that little world of that chaotic household I was growing up in. I did something that my dad didn't appreciate, and he went off on me. And one punishment led to another punishment, and for some reason I decided that night that I wasn't going to give him what I usually gave him when I got it bad enough, which was I'd cry. I wasn't going to cry that night. And so it went on, and it went on, and it went on. And the last thing I remember is being in the bedroom with him standing like 1,000 feet tall. You know, that 900-foot tall Jesus? This was 1,000-foot tall angry dad in the corner of the room. It's the last thing I remember until the next scene, me, 9 years old, in a windbreaker jacket on a cold November night in this suburbs of Chicago, walking down the front steps away from the house, thinking to myself, where am I going to go now? So that's my second blackout. After that night, my dad did come and get me. I was halfway around the block when he got me, and he didn't say anything, but he grabbed me by the shoulder and steered me back to the house. That was the last time he ever gave me a licking, physically. But, you know, the emotional stuff, the psychological, I never could do anything to satisfy him. I never was good enough. The things I was interested in were the wrong thing. So life stayed miserable. It didn't really get better, except that I wasn't getting hit anymore. So I turned into one of these little inward-turned guys, you know. I wasn't good at sports because I didn't find out I needed glasses until after the age when those things would have developed. But, you know, so I turned to reading and building models. You know, I had all these fantasy worlds going. That was my escape. Until the age of 16, I didn't have any friends of my own. But my brother, my younger brother, 2 years younger, had some buddies. And one night I wound up with my younger brother in the basement of one of his friends' homes. And the parents were out, and the liquor was there. And I thought, well, let's see what this does. And I sat down with a quart of rum and a bottle of Coke. Somewhere I'd heard rum and Coke was good stuff. So I poured the glass, mostly full of Coke, and poured some rum in, a little ice, stirred it up, and drank it. And a little while later, you know, with a little Coke and, you know, a little more rum. And till by the end, I think, anyway, there was about that much of the rum left in the bottle by the time I was done. And when I was done, I was really done. I was out in the back, in the yard, passed out. Not blacked out, I remember it all, but passed out. And I remember I would come to, I would drag myself away from the pool that I had left there the previous time I'd come to, I'd puke some more, drag myself back away from that pool, and pass out again. And that went on for, you know, God knows how long, probably a few hours. When I finally came to and didn't need to throw up anymore, I got up and I decided it was time to go home. I was 16 years old. My brother was 14. It was time for me to drive home now that I could walk. So my brother says, "No, wait a minute. I don't think that's such a good idea." I said, "Oh, we'll get in trouble if we get pulled over and you're driving because you don't have a driver's license yet." So I drove home. It was about 3 miles. I got there. The car was in one piece. All the fenders were still straight. But we had been off this road onto the sidewalk on both sides of the street on the way home. And when I pulled up in the driveway, I didn't even try and get in the family garage. I just left it in the middle of the driveway. As I'm walking up the steps to the front door, the lights come on. Mom's there. Thank God Dad was out of town. And her words were, "You're drunk." No argument. She led me to the kitchen table, made the universal cure for drunk, a pot of hot coffee, and set a cup in front of me. I guess I must have come to, and I saw the hot coffee, and I grabbed it and took a sip, and it was scalding hot. I put it back down, crossed my arms, and passed out again in the middle of a puddle of coffee. I came to the next morning, feel like I'd been beat up with baseball bats. My whole body hurt. The roots of my hair hurt. My eyes hurt from the sun. You know, everything hurt. I called in sick. I stayed home that day and moaned and groaned. But guess what? That was something I wanted to do again. I didn't want to get sick like I had. I didn't want to throw up like I had. I didn't want to hurt the next day as bad as I had. But man, I wanted to get drunk again. And I did. I made some friends my own age in high school for the first time so I could go drinking with the guys. And we'd go out and we'd get some beer, find somebody to give some money outside a convenience store to buy us some beer, you know, how it worked back in the 60s. And, you know, that was the deal. And we'd drive around and drink a few beers. The only high school dance I ever went to was when my buddy with the car pulled up and I wandered out with the rest of them and stood at the edge of the lighted area and watched everybody having a good time. So I wound up in college a couple of years later, and I didn't stop drinking. In fact, I managed to make myself a fake ID from a Florida driver's license. I was in school in Tennessee for 3 months. I was the guy, I was famous, you know, in my dorm, because I was the guy who could buy liquor. And I settled on, you know, I settled on Jim Beam, because it wasn't no name, but it wasn't, you know, real expensive either, right? So I always had a bottle of Jim Beam, and I was having a good time. I was doing okay in school, you know, I was getting enough done in classes. They let me know that if I kept my nose clean and kept going, that I'd be fine and I'd graduate and I'd get to do what I wanted. But one day in that first semester, that fall, something happened and somebody that I liked got blamed for punching a hole in a low sheetrock ceiling. And the guy who put the blame on my friend, who was a tall, strong, athletic kind of guy, was laughing about it in front of me. And, you know, like, oh, I got him, you know. I said, that's, anybody could do that. And here I was like 5'10", you know, and flabby and nothing. I said, anybody could do that. And right in front of the authority, I put my fist through the ceiling and got put on probation. I guess I had a problem with authority, you know. Maybe it started with my dad. So I got put on probation, which was okay. You know, it didn't bother me that much. Except that when I got back from Christmas break, I forgot I was on probation. And I went out drinking, and I didn't get back on time. And the RA that I punched a hole in the ceiling in front of went into my room and found my bottle of liquor and found my bag of the green leafy stuff and found the pills that I was already trying by then at 18. And I got thrown out of that school. But that didn't even stop things for long. It slowed me down for a little while. I got religion for a while. I prayed a lot. But I wrote a letter to my dad telling him about how praying was helping me, you know, keep it together. And it scared him. And he wrote me back a letter that I still have in a drawer somewhere. He said, don't take this prayer stuff too seriously. You know. So, I must have believed him because, I started drinking again. I remember sitting out in front of that next dorm with a quart bottle of Schlitz in a brown paper bag on a Friday afternoon, and we were back off to the races. That summer, I started buying pot in quantities, Retail ran in my family. I'd buy wholesale and sell retail and have a little left over for me and my friends and never really thought about it as generating any income. But, looking back on it, I always had money for gas or going out to eat or whatever I wanted pretty much. LPs, I could go into the record store. I never was concerned. That first term in college, it was like, I lost $20 in a poker game the first weekend I was in college. It was a crisis. A year later, I didn't give a damn. I was lubricated in all the ways I was learning to like to be lubricated. And the money was flowing. Life was good. Except about a year later, I got thrown out of that school, too. Because they had their rules. This time it didn't directly have anything to do with drugs or alcohol, but it that was always there. I drew attention because I didn't give a damn. I had a fast car. I drove it as fast as I could in the parking lot. It was a point of pride that I could hit 75 miles an hour in the school parking lot. So I became a known quantity at the school, and I got thrown out of there. Left, went to work, saved a bunch of money, decided I was going back to school where I'd gotten thrown out of. I was going to pick up where I left off and do good this time, right? My dad didn't like that idea. He tried to stop me. He took the fast car away. I said, okay. And the next day I bought a plane ticket and left. And they didn't see or hear from me for 4 months. That Christmas, my dad came and tracked me down in the middle of that fall. And he was surprised that I was going to school and that I was doing all right. I didn't tell him about the other stuff that was going on the side. I did wind up going to jail that fall with my roommates. Somebody bought something, seeing my success as a retailer, decided instead of buying a retail quantity of something, he'd buy wholesale from somebody he didn't know very well. And a couple of nights later, the cops showed up with a warrant and broke the door down and came in with their guns out and took us all to jail. None of us stayed in jail except the one night, but guess who went to drug school for 6 months every Saturday? I got some good stories from it, but I didn't really learn, because I wasn't ready yet. So, it went on like that. I eventually graduated from college. Let's see, one, two. I graduated from the third college I attended with the fourth major that I started in, and went to work to try and become a plant nurseryman. I was going to grow and sell cut flowers. I'd done it for somebody else. I knew I could do it for me. Again, though, I made a mistake. I tried to do something I'd never done before without asking anybody how to do it. I was going to, pretty much make it up as I went. And that's real hard. I thought I was a smart guy. I could figure it out. And, you can figure out a lot of things, but not everything. Not everything on your own in sufficient time to make it work as a business anyway. So as I got scared trying to do this business, instead of asking somebody how to get something done, I'd have a drink or have a joint or do something. And, time went by and I missed deadlines and I missed the first season I thought I'd have a crop. And my silent partner decided to call the game. And, so I was in a mess again. Here I was again. I'd gotten thrown out of something I'd put a lot of time and energy into. And this was the first thing, like a real bottom I had. Because I didn't have anything to do for a while. I didn't have any distractions. And I knew I'd screwed up this time. I really didn't understand how I'd screwed up, but I knew I'd screwed up, and I felt bad, and then I felt worse. And then, you know, having a few drinks every day and not doing much else, I felt awful and wanted to die. And then my wife got pregnant. And then I started to think about the religion that I'd been raised in. And started to research that, started to read, started to look back into something that I'd ignored for a while, and, you know, I hadn't understood it, so I let it go. And started to believe again in the religion, the church of my youth. Got to a spot, though. We were going to be in the first 10 children born in the first ever nurse midwife clinic in the state of Florida. And it turned out the nurse midwife had always worked under the immediate close supervision of a doctor who had screened the ladies that she worked with. And the tough ones he took, and the straightforward ones she got. So she didn't know how to screen. And out of the first 10, there were 9 C-sections, and we were one of them. And how it went was, my wife had 24 hours of hard labor in a little house on the north side of Gainesville, Florida, in a place where they had no privileges at any hospital in that community. So when it became clear that this thing wasn't working and wasn't going to work, and that, you know, my wife and my child, yet to be born, might just die that day, I became panicked. The lady drove us in her little Japanese station wagon, tiny little thing, my wife still in hard labor, to the hospital, to the emergency room, where they immediately put us into a labor room and started to prepare for an emergency C-section. And they put one of these monitors on the baby's head that was real easily accessible by then, though she was not yet born. And they had one of these LED readouts like you see in the movies on a bomb that's counting down, but it would go way up. It would go up 150, 160 beats per minute, heartbeat, and then it would go way down, you know, 50, 60, and it would go way up. And I knew enough to know that was real bad. Real, real bad. And the nurse that was in the room with us saw me looking at that thing and turned it away from me so I couldn't see it anymore. My wife had already been saying she was ready to die. And now I was concerned that, you know, they might both just die right then. And in that moment of being out of control, I turned my will and my life over to a higher power. I wasn't real sophisticated about it. I kind of made a business deal. I said, okay, God, I believe you're here and I believe you're in charge. And if you'll take care of these two, you can do whatever you want with me. I had no idea how that might work out or what my part of that deal might wind up being. But almost immediately, that distress that the baby had been displaying went away. And my wife got to what I call a second wind. She became calm and peaceful and not exhausted like she'd been. And where everything had been an emergency just a minute before, everything was fine. And the baby was born. It was a C-section, but it was not an emergency. And she was about as good as a baby can be, you know, and that there's a score of 1 to 10 or something. She was a 9, you know. Everything was fine. But now I had just cut a deal with, you know, the one who's in charge of it all. And I had to figure out what I was going to do about that. I think I must have thought that God was going to strike me with lightning, you know, to balance the bills. And it didn't happen that way, so I had to figure out what I was going to do next, how I was going to be responsible, you know, how I was going to fulfill this promise. And, you know, among other things, I was figuring out career direction. Of course, I crashed and burned once again. I crashed and burned schools. I crashed and burned majors. Now I crashed and burned a business. So I was looking at the possibility of changing careers. And one day my wife said, well, we had gone back to church by then. She said, you've been enjoying this church stuff so much, maybe you want to go to seminary. And I laughed and I laughed. I said, see, I've been raised Roman Catholic and we've been going to a Presbyterian church. I said, I've just started getting used to hanging out with the heretics and now you want me to become one of their leaders? You know, it didn't make much sense, but it didn't go away either. And about a year later, I wound up at seminary, at a Presbyterian seminary, and about 5 years later, I wound up being ordained. And for the next 20 years, I was a pastor, or an associate pastor in three different churches. But the drinking and the other stuff didn't stop, ever, you know. Golly. Who knew, right? Mysterious, powerful, baffling. I didn't even think of it as a problem for most of my life. What happened was about 1993, we moved to a new town, a small town, a small church. And one evening, early that fall, you know, I was in the habit of waiting out my kids and my wife. My wife got up, you know, earlier than I do. She needed more sleep than I do. Always has, always will, I guess. The kids were in school. They'd go to bed. She'd start getting ready for bed. I'd have a little glass of something through the evening, but then I'd sneak out onto the patio when nobody was looking and have a little something else, too. Well, I smoked my little bit of something and came back in, and the phone rang. And it was one of my parishioners. And it was a person who was the wife of one of the responsible lay leaders, you know, people on the board of that congregation. And she needed to talk to her pastor. She had a problem. And her pastor was scrambled. You know, I was pretty high. And I was pretty scared. Because I was pretty sure that she'd be able to tell somehow that I was messed up, and that she would tell her husband, and her husband would tell his peers, and they would tell everybody else, and my pretty little boat was going to sink fast. I was in a panic from that moment on. From the moment I answered that phone, I was in a panic. Now, you got to understand that 4 years before that, a member of my family had been attending a related 12-step program. There had been a copy of the 12 and 12 on a table in my living room, and one afternoon I wound up picking it up and reading through and going, oh, this is pretty cool. I wish there was a program like this for people like me. But in the meantime, I figured out this stuff that I told you about, you know, there being alcoholics in my family. And I'd come to the conclusion that, in addition to previous generations, that my dad had been a dry drunk, and so that made me qualified for adult children of alcoholics. Well, okay, I thought I had a marijuana problem too, right? Because that was what triggered this panic. So, as soon as I could, I don't know if it was the next night, but as soon as I could, I found a meeting 45 miles away, at night, downtown, somewhere way far away from where I lived. And I took my wife, and we went to the meeting. Why I took my wife, I don't know. She didn't have a problem. She wasn't even using that stuff anymore by then. I went to that meeting, I sat down, and as soon as those people started talking, I knew that they had what I needed. But I didn't take a white chip. They must have offered one, right? That's what we do. All of our 12-step fellowships offer, you know, chips. I didn't take a white chip. And I never went back. my wife didn't need to go. So I figured, I told myself I could do it by myself. It didn't look like it had been that hard for them. They were peaceful. They were okay. I was a mess. And it didn't work out so well. The next 9 years became... I marched down the really steep steps through the layers of hell until I got to what is called in our literature the jumping off place. I proved to myself over and over again that I could stop. You know, as soon as I did what I did, I would become miserable. I would become guilt-ridden. I would become ashamed of myself. I would swear I would never do it again. And maybe for 6 days, I would not do it again. But then on that sixth day, my day of the week was Monday. My kids were in school. My wife was at work. And I did what I did and became more and more miserable. I became more and more unable to cope with normal life. When the people, the church I was employed by, said, you know, the church has been shrinking over the years little by little, and we've gotten to a place where we can't afford to keep you full time, but we'd love it if you could stay part time. I thought about it, and I talked to my wife, and I thought about my son who was about to start college the next summer, my daughter who was about to graduate from college, and I told him, I wished I could, but I can't afford to take that drop in my income. Little did I know, I was entering unemployment for the next 15 of the next 18 months I was to be unemployed. And I figured out afterward that I was unemployed and I never got a call back, because when I walked up to you and handed you my resume, though the resume looked good, there was death in my eyes. Because when I looked in the mirror, that's what I saw. And I had studied, the internet was available by then, I'd studied suicide, and I'd find out how hard it was to do it right. So 9 years later, 2004, I found myself all alone in the house because the wife had to move away to make up for the lost income from me being incapable. The kids were away. One daughter had graduated and gotten a job and moved away. The son had started college. And 2 weeks alone in that house were enough for me to find my bottom. The bottom was a day when I knew I couldn't quit, and I knew I couldn't bear to not quit. And I was going to kill myself, and I was going to do it with a shotgun, and I knew I had the method figured out. And I was calm. For the first time in 9 years, I was calm, because my misery was about to be over. And then sitting there, I thought that about somebody finding the mess that I was going to leave, and calling the cops, and them calling my wife, and somebody having to tell my kids, and my dad, and my siblings, and my nieces and nephews, and, you know, that kind of ruined the deal. It wasn't going to work for me anymore. And I remember just sitting there. I don't even know how long I sat there. I think it was about 3 o'clock that afternoon when I heard some words that I'd heard 6 months before. And I'd suggested to a therapist that maybe I'd try a 12-step group in addition to what I was doing in therapy. And she'd said, I think if you got yourself to one of those meetings, you'd find something for you there. And I heard those words again. And I got up off the floor, and I turned on the computer, and I found a meeting. And it was 3 hours later, half an hour up the road, which left me enough time to get a shower, get some food in my belly, and get some clean clothes on. And again, when I walked in that room, I didn't even have to hear him say anything. When I walked in that room and met the eyes of the people in there, I knew I was going to be okay. And it has been. It's not always been great. It's not always been, and it isn't right now, everything I want it to be. But, you know, I'm not in charge. I'm not the judge. I don't have to judge me anymore. I don't have to be ashamed of myself anymore. I don't have to be guilty about most everything that I do every day anymore. Because when I got here the second time, instead of walking away, maybe buying a book, like I'd always done before, you know, I was great with books. I just wasn't great with living. I stayed. I got a sponsor. That first night, well, the second night, right? The second night, my second meeting, I got a sponsor. And I started working the steps. And when some months later, I came here to Atlanta to be with my wife, who by some weird miracle I'm still married to after a lot of years, I started looking again for meetings, for a sponsor, for a program. And I was led to NABBA finally, and to Jim, and to the early morning study group, and the 5:45, and this meeting, and the Thursday night men's meeting, and all kind of wonderful meetings around town, Delano, and all kind of other clubhouses and churches, and all kinds of people who might not look anything much at all like me, but have problems that are an awful lot like mine, and have found solutions that work just fine for me. If I'll just give them, you know, what energy and will that I can bring to bear that day and accept the result just for today. I kind of wish I'd spent more time with you tonight talking about the steps part of it. But, you know, it's different each time. I even wrote down here, I had it all lined out in neat parts. But maybe somebody here needed to hear that, or maybe I just needed to tell it that way this time and hear it myself. I don't know. There's three things I found out about my higher power, and I was terrified of my higher power when I got here. Well, the power of my misunderstanding was either didn't exist or was a monster, right? So, with the example of guys with some time in the program, I was able to figure out three things. My higher power speaks to me through alcoholics and sometimes other people. My higher power has a real strong connection with what I think of as love. And my higher power has a weird sense of humor. So thanks for listening. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you, Chris. That was beyond cool. We've asked Julie to come up and hand out the chips.
Hey, everybody, I'm Julie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
thank you, Chris. That was fun. We have a chip system here at this meeting to denote our time in sobriety. And we have I'm going to go through them one time and give them out each time as I go along. We have a white chip for anybody who wants to come into our way of life for the first time or after some experimentation. Does anybody need a white chip? Right? We have a silver chip for 30 days. Does anybody have 30 days? We have a red chip for 90 days. Anybody have 90? We have a yellow chip for 6 months. 6 months? Green for 9 months? Any birthday? Oh, all right. All right. Well.
Family, my name is Big Bird. Some of my friends call me Tall Paul. I am an alcoholic. This is seven. There's a lot of things I've done that have to do with Alcoholics Anonymous and other fellowships. I'm not just trapped at one fellowship. That's because I kind of qualified for a bunch of them. So the things that I have done was what the people did that were successful before me. I got a sponsor. I got a God. And I found the literature and I began to read it. And reading it wasn't just enough for me. I had to become willing to study it. because this is a way of life, and reading about life and actually acting life are two different things, and somebody has to teach you, so therefore you have to study. And I'm real grateful for that. You know, my sponsor told me I always pick these up for 7 meetings in a row, but my health has been such that I haven't been able to make 7 meetings in a row. So this is the last time I'll pick this up. It's 7, and I appreciate it.
We offer the white chip one more time for anybody who's rethought about that. Anybody? All right. Congratulations, Paul.
Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
Bye.